So the CISO's got to take advantage of that and educate them about our language, teach them to understand our language. And just like, you know, the first time you go to a board meeting, you're just like, what are these people talking about? You turn it around on them and take the high ground and let them raise their hand and say, oh, what's a targeted attack? What's ransomware? They should know this stuff. And it's the CISO's job to educate them about what they're talking about and the threat it poses.
You're listening to KBCast, the cybersecurity podcast for all executives. Cutting through the jargon and hype to understand the landscape where risk and technology meet. Now, here's your host, Carissa Breen.
Hey everyone, it's KB. Thank you for being an active listener on the show. And thanks to you, we've been downloaded in 63 countries. If you haven't already, please ensure that you follow and subscribe to the show for the latest updates. Now, time to get to the interview. Joining me today is Richard Steenen, Chief Research Analyst from IT Harvest, and today we're discussing Richard's insights on the cybersecurity industry as he sees it. So Richard, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having me, Carissa.
Now, Richard, I really want to start with a little bit about you, your history. You've got quite a long history in the industry. So talk me through what you've seen in your years of analyzing this space. I'm really interested to know.
Yeah, you know, when I started at Gartner, my fellow analyst, who was the first industry analyst that covered security at Gartner, John Pescatore, told me, you know, the great thing about our industry is it's never the next big thing, but it's always part of the next big thing. So while that's true, security is always part of the next big thing, think cloud and IoT, et cetera. Shortly after he said that, security became the next big thing in and of itself. And the industry, which was valued at maybe $2 billion back in 2000, is, you know, now estimated over $300 billion. And I've watched as some old themes constantly come back. But the one thing this industry have that's different from every sector of technology is an outside driver, which is the threat actors. So not only are all the vendors in the space competing with each other to improve their feeds and speeds, usability, you know, competing on costs like in any technology industry. There's a whole nother group of people that we don't know very well unless they're arrested and prosecuted by various law enforcement agencies. Are those people, the threat actors, are constantly trying to subvert all the security. So they're being innovative, inventive, entrepreneurial, and creating new business models, all to steal money, information, and, you know, in the case of espionage and information warfare, you know, to actually subvert elections and sovereignty of various countries. So that whole spread keeps growing. And it's the hardest thing is to predict what those bad actors are going to do because they've got their own market or the things they're doing. But you watch the two sides of it, and you know that the security industry will always be here and will always be growing.
So you mentioned before old themes. What are some of the old themes that you see sort of coming back?
A couple in the identity space. First of all, the new passwordless that's been pretty new, I guess, term coined. And when you dig into it, it's not passwordless at all. It's just that the password is a digital certificate that's, you know, written and then digitally signed and encrypted, et cetera, and lodged on your device, often in the web browser on your device. That is what we used to call client-side certificates, which was a very common way to make sure that the connection between two parties was, you know, secure and encrypted, but it required, you know, somebody's client to have the digital keys. And today that's what passwordless is. What's changed is that all the devices have secure enclaves in silicon, sometimes a separate chip like a trusted platform module, but now just embedded in every new modern Intel chip. And that's a special enclave within the silicon that is, you know,
hasn't been shown to be vulnerable to being hacked into. I don't say it's unhackable. Who knows? And now the companies are coming to the fore that are saying, you know what, when you enroll somebody, you just have them answer a bunch of questions, use whatever fingerprint or face recognition on their device. And now we've mapped that device to that person, to their account credentials, and we're done. Every time they use that device, they're automatically in. There's, you know, no friction to getting online and no passwords to remember.
Got you. Okay, that totally makes sense. So going back to terms that are coined, now there's a lot of them, as you would know, whether it's passwordless, it's zero trust, it's artificial intelligence, machine learning, whatever else. Do you think from your experience, people get a bit fatigued as soon as someone says, oh, it's passwordless, for example? Do people sort of eyes glaze over? Because it's like, oh, I've heard this now 50 times. Or what's your sort of insight?
They do for some. Passwordless is a good example. And certainly artificial intelligence and machine learning, because, you know, everybody that has an algorithm claims that. And I know my eyes glaze over and I stop listening if, you know, unless you start showing me the actual, you know, supervised learning model you use or unsupervised learning model, which nobody does, right? All they do is just make a claim, you know, and all they're talking about is automation and the same thing we heard 22 years ago with, you know, Bezier curve fitting. It's all the same stuff. So that's another one. Zero trust, certainly another one. People's eyes glaze over when you talk about that because, you know, the big analyst firms, Gartner in particular, but zero trust is a Forrester term, come up with these overarching concepts and, you know, put them out there. People like it. The vendors adopt it immediately because it gives them some fresh kind of approach. And so everybody jumps on board. I did a survey of the 3,000 vendors we track, and 228 of them put zero trust front and center on their homepages. Yeah, it just it keeps coming up. Gartner will occasionally do completely stupid things with their new categorizations. You know, we've got, you know, a major bucket. As a matter of fact, in terms of number of vendors, the largest bucket is the governance, risk, and compliance vendors. And so GRC is, you know, been around before the internet. And Gartner came in and said, no, we're going to call it integrated risk management. And, you know, so it's IRM, which, you know, the people have been around for a while. IRM means information rights management. It's totally different than integrated risk management. So now you've got companies that are GRC vendors that have to say their IRM on their website. And it's unfortunate because, you know, there's no VP of IRM at a company. There's a VP of privacy and VP of compliance, and they're looking for GRC. You know, that's what they got their certifications in. So it's a disservice to the vendors to immediately jump on a bandwagon just so they can be included in a new Gartner Magic Quadrant. The other one like that that gets under my skin is there's, you know, this industry of, I think I count 98 or so vendors that do threat intelligence. And everybody knows what that is, right? You're gathering data from open source or the dark web, and you're feeding it to customers so that they can use it in their various tools. Gartner came by and they said, no, we're going to call that digital risk protection. So, you know, if you're going to come up with a three-letter acronym, at least it should mean something. But, you know, digital is totally redundant because nobody in cybersecurity is talking about analog stuff except people in information warfare, which is all about radar and radio signals. And, you know, nobody can define risk anyway, so why have that? And at the end of the day, grammatically, we don't want to protect our risks, right? You want to ameliorate them. You want to reduce your risk. So digital risk reduction would even be better.
Yeah, that is interesting. Okay, so you mentioned something before, 228 vendors say they do zero trust. Now, I don't know whether it was you or someone else a few years ago came out with a report on companies that claimed they did machine learning, but in fact, it was like not many at all. So those 228, are they in reality doing zero trust, or is this a claim?
Yeah, it's just a claim. They fit into
you know, Zero Trust was, which is actually an architecture or a way of thinking about security, but it's usually because they're identity vendors. And Zero Trust is all, you know, all about binding identities to, you know, your digital identity to a real person that's properly enrolled, and then often binding it to the devices they use, and then cutting out the network so that the application on the other side that somebody's logging into doesn't care that they're on the corporate network or dialing in from home. That you don't have to trust them just because they happen to be on the corporate network. That's the Zero Trust part of it. So, yeah, so it's, I think, you know, since you're not shopping for a Zero Trust product, you still go ahead and shop for an identity product, an authentication product, you know, a directory services product. You know, you're still looking for all the old products, but you may have just changed your approach, right? We're going to make everybody log in with systems where we can monitor their access and use the identity as a primary control instead of what network segment they're on.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So you mentioned before bandwagon. Now, what frustrates you about some of the bandwagons that you've seen in your time? I'm just curious to know and hear your thoughts.
Oh boy, struck a nerve there.
Anything you'd like to share?
Yeah, yeah. So one of, you know, there are many. I'm somewhat of an iconoclast, right? So if everybody's saying something, then it's just part of me says I've got to take the other approach. So I hate several things. The constant claim that the user is the weakest link and the front line. And because the solutions provided for that are security awareness training. I think security awareness training is useless. It's, you know, it's done, you know, even the very, very best phishing simulation provider claims 98% effectiveness. Well, if you're only 98% effective, that means if I'm a phisher, I have to send 50 emails, you know, to get one, to get one person to click on something. That's, you know, it costs them zero to send 50 emails, and they're going to get through. Another one on the other end, on the CISO side, is this constant telling CISOs that they have to learn to speak the business language. They have to, you know, stop talking bits and bytes, and when they go to the board meetings, they've got to use the CFO's language. And I think that's totally wrong. They should never do that. It means that they have to go into a meeting and show charts about risk, which you already know. I think the risk measurements and those risk claims are totally false, right? You do not know what the attacker wants. So you can't look at all of your assets and decide which one is the most valuable asset. It might be valuable to you because you use it every day, but the attacker's after maybe your least ranked or scored asset, because that gives them a foothold, and then they get to the crown jewels. If you speak the CFO's language, they immediately go, oh, okay, so the highest risk is, you know, from ransomware attackers. Okay, let's buy some cyber insurance against ransomware. And so it's a, you know, because they think it's the same as a risk of a commodity price going up or the risk of a supplier getting flooded and not being able to give you the equipment you need, and that they can defer that risk and reduce that risk with insurance or other measures. And it's just a false start altogether.
Interesting. Okay, so why does that frustrate you so much? Because I do see your point, but I do see the other side of it as well. I think when people say you've got to speak the CFO's language, it comes from a point of like trying to find like common ground, because CFO is not going to necessarily understand security at like the minute level. So I think there's a bit of that in there, but I'm just trying to understand your point and where you're coming from. And then I guess as a follow-up, how would you recommend people go to the board? Because this is the biggest, well, one of the biggest challenges people have when it comes to the communication side of things.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So the frustration comes from the fact that we've been, you know, Don Rumsfeld, the U.S. Secretary of State, between his stints, Secretary of Defense, between his stints at heading up the military, worked in industry and insurance particularly. So when he comes back in, he was all talking risk. And he started getting the government to talk about risk. All of a sudden, all of NIST's, which is our National Institutes of Standards and Testing, started to produce frameworks and guidance based on risk management principles. So it's totally permeated. We've been doing it for 22 years and nothing changes. We still succumb to targeted attacks. So maybe that means we should do something else, like fight the attacks. And I like to use, military and, government examples. You think of the leader of your country getting a intelligence briefing every morning. I guarantee you, the intelligence agencies are sitting in the office telling them about the various risk profiles of their assets deployed around the world. The U.S. has 238 military bases, and those probably never come up in the security briefing that the President of the United States gets. The intelligence community gathers intelligence, and the briefings will say, Al-Qaeda in Western Africa is starting to move here, and we're picking up chatter that they're targeting printer cartridges put on airplanes to blow up. Those are, direct threats. They're not risks. And so that's just kind of the metaphor I use to understand the difference between threats and risk. And in your own home, yes, there's a risk that somebody's going to break in at any time. You've got a risk. And so you could invest a lot of money to reduce that risk. You could get, bars on your windows and alarm systems and automatic lights turn on and a guard dog in your yard, which, nobody does just because the risk exists. But they do when the threat exists, right? When your neighbor gets broken into, then you start upping your security. When the police tell you there's an armed person running around on the street, I'm talking about U.S. here, that's when you lock the door and don't open the door.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So that's that perspective. Now, how should the CISO communicate to the board? Do it the way that I hear security people talking at conferences. It's fantastic. They can get into the nuts and bolts of a particular type of attack and make it fascinating, because it is fascinating. It's amazing stories. And I came to this realization when I talked to the CISO of Lockheed Martin. And she would meet with the executive team every week, and she would have one chart, and it was lined up based on the cyber kill chain. At the time, nowadays, people would use the MITRE attack framework. But the cyber kill chain, starts with reconnaissance and initial access, or weaponization, then initial access and moving across your network, and finally exfiltration. They would track attacking teams working against them. They had 30 people working day and night to monitor activity on their network and their endpoints. And they would identify the signs of an attack ongoing. They would usually be able to identify that this team is using this set of tools, and they usually operate between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. Beijing time. And we're going to call it something. They just label it. Cheesy Fingers was one of the teams they use. And she goes in to the executive board meeting, and she just shows a chart of that team and that they've been watching for weeks and how far they've gotten into the network based on the cyber kill chain. That plays to the emotions of the executives, and it works for the boards as well, because we all like to think that the board of directors of a big company, are carefully thinking through and balancing decisions, etc. And yet every single day we see them doing bizarre acquisitions that make no sense. That we see them making financial moves that also make no sense. And it's because they, like every other human on the planet, is driven by emotion. And somebody, at Symantec in the old days might see that, hey, McAfee just acquired
a two-factor authentication company. So we need to acquire a two-factor authentication company. Who's the best one? They just buy that one because they're working from, you know, they shoot from the hip. They are, you know, motivated by, you know, competitive and defensive nature. So the CISO's got to take advantage of that and educate them about our language, teach them to understand our language. And just like a, you know, the first time you go to a board meeting, you're just like, what are these people talking about? Internal rate of return and, you know, all these, their own lingo. You turn it around on them and take the high ground and let them raise their hand and say, oh, what's a targeted attack? What's ransomware? You know, they should know this stuff. And it's the CISO's job to educate them about what they're talking about and the threat it poses.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, that makes so much more sense. So what I was hearing as you were speaking, Richard, is like when you go to a doctor and they're like, hey, you've got this disease. And you're like, well, what's that? Like, you don't just go, oh, okay. And then you walk out. They then explain to you what it means.
Exactly.
Like, this is what it means.
That's great. Yeah.
So I think it's probably more so the CFO, for example, being inquisitive on the other end, not sort of just dismissing it and being like, oh, okay, well, that's just your... that's your area, Mr. Sizo, Mrs. Sizo. Yeah. So I think that it has to be reciprocal on both ends. So
yeah,
I think that's a better way of approaching
it. If your doctor tells you you're at risk of, you know, becoming diabetic because you're overweight, you don't listen to them, right? But if they say, hey, your liver's failing because you drink too much, then you do something about it.
Correct. And then they'll use terminology that you as a person won't understand. Yeah. So you ask them.
Totally. Totally.
Gotcha. Or you that makes sense.
Take notes and look it up when you get home.
True. Okay. So now I want to sort of explore with you some recent insights. Maybe you can share with our audience that you've sort of seen recently, last few months or last 6 months or even last 12 months. So I'm really keen to hear your thoughts.
All right. Okay. So in the last 12 months, I built and launched a platform that's so much better than my spreadsheets that I've kept for 17 years in the industry. And, you know, it takes a lot of work, about 4,000 hours of work to do this. You have to look at every single participant and figure out what they do and then track them month to month. Are they growing? Are they shrinking? Are they taking investment? Are they changing, you know, the CEO out, whatever. You track all that. But once you've categorized them, then you look at the category as a whole. And I break the industry down into 17 categories that's aligned with the classic defense in depth model, right? So you got network on the outside, you got endpoint on the inside, you've got identity, you know, all these fit into this model easily. It's very understandable. Nobody can argue with it, I guess. And once you've done that, then you say, okay, of these 17 sectors, which one grew in headcount the most last quarter? And this insight just jumps out at you because you put it on a little bar graph. And API security is growing twice as fast as any other sector. Now, it's a small sector, right? It only employs a total of 2,000 people, but it's growing at that compounded annual rate. Grew 60% last year. And so you look at that. The other thing is, okay, who's shrinking the most? And oddly, fraud prevention is, you know, growing 1 or 2% a year, which is abysmal. And it tells me, all the e-commerce sites and banks have fraud prevention solutions, finally. You have to, or you'd be losing so much money that you'd go out of business. And it's gotten the fraud levels down to a manageable level. So the fraud prevention industry is only growing at 2%. An area that I'm not happy about because I think that deception is awesome. You know, it's just such a cool thing. And deception is this idea that you put breadcrumbs all over your network and you lead an attacker once they're in your network to a honeypot. And then, you know, they detonate their malware in the honeypot and you get to see how they act. And every single alert from that honeypot is an alert of a real attacker. So you can watch what they do. And if they've done that and successfully compromised your standard image of a Windows machine, wow, you better go make sure your Windows machines can defend against that in the future if they find out that, you know, there's another path into your network. So the deception space is only out of those 17 categories. It's only one that's shrinking so far this year, down a couple percent in total headcount.
Wow. Okay. So 17 years of spreadsheets. You are right. I'm glad that you've now transformed that into a platform, which I've seen. And I think it's great. And I know that you release lots of insights on your LinkedIn. So I think that's valuable for people. And because you're obviously tracking it with, you know, it's not anecdotal. It's actually driven by a science and a math. So I appreciate that. And you know, you've got a lot of engagement online. So people obviously appreciate it as well. So then with those insights, what would you say is sort of missing then in the cybersecurity arena at the moment?
We do not have a solution to the SolarWinds problem. So if you think about it, you know, SolarWinds was, you know, probably one of the most successful nation state campaigns to infiltrate organizations, right? So SolarWinds software update was compromised with a backdoor. The software was, you know, encrypted, digitally signed, and sent from the correct server to the servers at 18,000 of their customers, and they installed the updates, which immediately gave the attackers the SRV in Russia, so their spy agency, access to those systems. Devastating. You know, just an awful, awful result. You know, kudos to them, because that's a very sophisticated attack. But it's not the first time that software updates have been compromised. So there's probably about five examples, I think. But the most important is NotPetya, the most damaging attack in our history so far, where the Russian GRU Sandworm team infiltrated a little tiny software company in Ukraine that provided the equivalent of QuickBooks to all their customers. So they targeted a Ukrainian software company with a big Ukrainian footprint. This was obviously, you know, meant to damage Ukraine. Of course, it spilled over into all of Europe and some around the world to some extent. And you know, compromised the update with malware, using malware developed by the NSA. And that was distributed to all the customers, and it just blew up within hours. You know, you had TNT, big shipping provider down, you know, a logistics company, Maersk, the shipping company, and in total, billions of dollars was lost from that one attack. So the worst methodology of an attack, and there's no defense against it, because the defense would be to somehow have a way to check a software update to see if it was malicious. And I don't have the answer. I'm not sure how you do that. You could reverse engineer it maybe and just look at the changed stuff, assuming the previous version was okay. But, you know, whatever it is, it's going to be complicated, but everybody needs it to be assured that their updates are secure. Instead, the industry is doubling down on shift left, which is, hey, SolarWinds, you just have to do a better job of security so that an attacker can't get on a developer's laptop and compromise their software. Great, fine. SolarWinds, definitely you should be better at security, and that shouldn't happen to you. Go ahead and do it. Well, that's SolarWinds. There are millions of software providers, and we can't change the world by just berating them that they're not secure enough. You're not going to get millions of software developers to change the way they develop software. And so so we're shouting into the wind once again. Here in the United States, you know, the CISA and NIST have, you know, created frameworks and constantly tell people, got to get better at this. And it's just not going to do anything. It, you know, gives them something to talk about. They sound smart when they're talking about it, but it's not going to work.
Yeah, okay. That I've actually interviewed someone from SolarWinds, and most of the interview was about their breach. Day that we're speaking today, it hasn't been published, so it should come out soon. It's quite interesting insights.
I need that because I'm writing a book.
Perfect. Okay, I'll definitely send it to you. In the wild soon. The other thing is, so does someone then have an answer? So you're saying people are just sort of shouting into the wind, no one's really like, you know, maybe they're not looking at the problem the right way. So do you think that someone's working on it out there, or who knows?
I'm sure somebody's working on it. I expected to start getting briefings by now from Israeli startups that had solved it or have a solution for it. I haven't heard it yet. You know, obviously I don't talk to everybody, but I want to start hearing about these solutions because that'll be a very big company. Maybe somebody in Australia should do it. You know, there's
maybe fantastic. People forget about us down here.
Yeah. There are 54 vendors in Australia and they should, you know, one of them could figure this out easily.
Well, for people that are listening, if you've won a business idea, there's one to get you started. Maybe speak to Richard about some of his insights. Okay, so I want to talk about vendors now. Now, people often say, whether in the United States or Australia, like there's just too many vendors, there's just so many of them. But you think otherwise. Now, talk to me about this, and then how many vendors are there exactly from your perspective as of today?
As of today, there are 3,170. And that's worldwide. And I know I haven't captured them all because we had about 10 a day. But I suspect it's going to slow down. And they're probably 4,000 is the top number. But we'll exceed that over years because the space keeps growing. And, you know, with the explosion in technology, that just creates new need for new type of vendors. So right now we're seeing IoT security vendors do extremely well because we're trying to fix, you know, the billions of IoT devices that have been deployed. The cloud probably is responsible for introducing the most vendors because, you know, everything you had in the past has to be replicated in the cloud. And the cloud is actually easier to do that with, right? Because it's all virtual and it's all discoverable. It's somewhat standardized, at least within the same infrastructure as a service provider. And that's just going to keep going. You know, a lot of people are talking about the metaverse and the security problems that will evolve there. So sure enough, there'll be things to secure the metaverse going forward. And that's going to continue forever. You know, when you think about, first of all, when Edward Snowden revealed the extent of the surveillance state that the NSA had created, that created a distrust of U.S. companies, right? Because at the time, Yahoo and Apple and Google and all of those vendors were in the documents that Edward Snowden leaked. And they were assisting the NSA to do this collection. So if you're in a very privacy conscious world, like anybody in the EU, you're going to be just totally shocked and not want to have your data reside on a US company's servers, regardless of where they're located. And for that matter, the US is contributing to what I call digital mercantilism by pushing back on Chinese vendors of technology products. They make these spurious claims that Huawei gear is spying on stuff. And that's a two-edged sword because, you know, people in Europe are going to go, yeah, what about Cisco gear? You know, I'm sure there's some former NSA person on Cisco's staff or board, et cetera. And so I'm not going to trust Cisco gear either. I want, you know, a European-produced security product to replace all my Checkpoint or all my Cisco or all my Fortinet, et cetera. And that's led to a splintering of our industry so that there are local vendors of every single one of those 17 categories and 660 subcategories. So for a country to feel like they're not beholden to the US or some other major country, they have to have their own native security solutions. So now, you know, we track security solutions coming from 70 countries today. But if there's 600 in each one, that's 4,200 vendors that will probably exist someday. And that's, you know, just everything is just conspiring to make more vendors, not fewer. Now, the one thing that I'll push back on, because maybe because personally I suffered from this back, you know, when I was younger, I worked at a company that sold Sun Microsystems servers. And back then I just countered all the time the pushback, no, we're standardizing on Windows NT because it's, you know, I can buy 10 Windows NT machines for the cost of one Sun Microsystems machine. And I can hire somebody out of high school to manage them because it's all a graphical interface. And so this concept that we're going to rationalize our supplier base and focus on one only plays into the hands of the established biggest vendor. And they support it. You know, so Cisco will be the first to tell you, get all your stuff from Cisco. And of course, Microsoft's been that way. And IBM used to hold that seat. And that, you know, that dynamic is always going to go on, and really big, you know, companies want to rationalize their supply base because it gives them more negotiating power, but they're always compromised because the opposite argument is to buy best of breed, which I'm a big believer in, right? You should have the best security product for each function. And if you say, well, yeah, but you know, if we buy it from Fortinet, we'll get something that's good enough. Right, we'll use Fortinet SIM and Fortinet two-factor authentication, and Fortinet has a phone, the Forti phone, for our conference system. So we're not going to use, you know, the one that we've used all these years. We're just going to buy everything from Fortinet, and it's just silly. That's not going to happen. Crosses domains within the organization. Who, you know, the people who buy phones are not the same people who buy UTM devices, and so they're not going to put up with that. So it's just, you know, it. We'll talk about it. There'll be articles written about it, but it's not going to happen.
So where do you think people say there's just too many vendors? Does that come from them, for example, a CISO, they've got like 50 pitches in their inbox every day. Do you think it stems from that? Because I mean, when you and I spoke, you said that some people don't need like high level enterprise stuff. They may need a vendor that's more suitable for SME, for example. And that's why we have many of them. Do you think people miss that point then? They're just like, oh, I just get pitched at day in, day out, and I'm over it, and therefore there are too many vendors.
Yeah, if your job isn't to track all the vendors and understand that they some sell to consumers, some sell to whoever, and you just see a list of all the vendors that do something, the stuff I post on LinkedIn all the time, they say there are too many. The market can't support them, but they don't look at the bigger picture. And they don't want, you know, it's almost a, I don't know if it's lazy, but they don't want to have to know what all these vendors do and be able to differentiate between them. They don't have time, right? They've decided, you know, look at it. I spent a lot of time learning about Splunk, and Splunk is good enough. Yeah, it's horribly expensive and they're not responsive to small customers, but you know, we don't need the other 50 SIM vendors out there. That goes on all the time. Have you ever been to like a major used book sale? And you just, here in the US, they hold them in malls and there's just million books laid out. And you go, wow, you know, you could say, because you're never going to read them all, you could say there are too many books. We should just winnow it down to the best books, right? Or books published by one publisher. You know, that I know it's a spurious argument because it just doesn't make sense.
Well, that saying strokes are different folks. Is that?
Yeah.
Do you think that's
totally. That's
what
it.
We should be adapting here in the industry?
That's it. Exactly.
So I've got a question for you. Just say, okay, you're a large vendor. They've got market share, okay, because they've been around for a long time, which is fair enough, right? They've earned their place. How does a smaller vendor who may be better, cheaper, this, that, whatever, more agile, integrates quicker, whatever, how could they potentially overturn a larger vendor?
Ah, great question. Because usually, you know, if they even get close to doing that, the larger vendor just buys them. You know, probably the best example, and it's still in play right now, is Zscaler. So in 2008, the founder, Jay Chaudhry, looked at what was going on in particular in the what's called a secure web gateway, right? Which is nothing more than firewall to prevent bad stuff coming in, and a list of inappropriate websites for employees to browse to. And that's what Bluecoat was. That's what WebSense was. Those solutions were enterprise solutions that fit in the corporate network environment of a data center and a headquarters office. And you had $100,000 appliance that did all that blocking and tackling for you. And that, Fortinet came along and said, yeah, but what about the distributed enterprise that has 5,000 locations, hotels, retail, restaurants, distributors, et cetera. So they came up, as did all the UTM vendors. So WatchGuard and SonicWall. Got to mention Red Piranha, based in Perth, I believe. They came up with a simple, low-cost appliance that you just put in your office of 10 or 20 people, and it would provide all the same functionality as this million-dollar stack of equipment you needed in your data center. Jay Chaudhry looked at it, and he thought, well, what about the mobile user? So in 2008, which is about the time that the iPhone was taking off, he had the vision of a future where people would use their mobile devices to access corporate assets and go out on the internet. And they could go out on the internet and browse inappropriate stuff from the corporate headquarters, right? So now you've got all the issues that come with people looking at pornography or sports betting sites or whatever from work. How are you going to protect that and stop that? And so he said, I need a solution that's all in the cloud, cloud native. All the network connections go directly to the cloud instead of back to the corporate headquarters. And with that one vision, he displaced the need for massive hardware security appliances, which Cisco produced, Palo Alto produced, Fortinet produced, et cetera, with a simple, per user pricing, just, enroll them. And then when they connect, they're essentially on a VPN and all their traffic is proxied, and we can log it and set policies all in the cloud. So simple to deploy, no massive investment in gear, it's still expensive to do it this way. So they completely shifted, taking advantage out of the dual trends of cloud and mobile to displace an entire category of security appliances. And now, normally I would say, I always think, oh my God, this is the way the world is going. And, the other vendors that do this, Netskope, Cato, dozen others, are going to completely displace the Palo Altos of the world. Yet, Fortinet's probably the highest flying security stock today. I think the most highly valued company in security, still selling those appliances. So it turns out that cloud and modern architectures are still not penetrated as deeply as one would expect if you're you're like me, right? We're practically living in the future. It shocks us to discover, as we did a year and a half ago, that there are 30,000 companies that have Exchange servers on premises. We just assume everybody does it the modern way, that because it's lower cost, more effective, more uptime, etc. But that's the reality is no. It's only the early adapters are there today.
Wow. Okay. So I guess it's going to take a bit of time, and how you go about doing it. I mean, I can think along the lines from a marketing brand media perspective, which is different. But again, I think that there are really good players out there. I mean, equally that, that a lot of the big companies, they're there because they are good as well. And I think that there is opportunity, because a lot of people say we're only a small company, how do we grow? And I was like, well, I can only help you for these areas, but I think things that you've touched on now are things that people can take away for their journey to get to that growth.
Yeah, and keep an eye on founder-led big companies. So in Checkpoint, Palo Alto, and Fortinet are included in that, because Nir Zuk still calls the shots at Palo Alto. Founder-led companies, or or Trend Micro, my favorite, because Eva Chen is one of the founders and she's still at the helm. They have the ability to see, you know, future threats to their business and take action and drive a direction, a technological direction for the company. Big conglomerates, you know, Symantec and CA and very soon VMware, right, are going to be all in this big conglomerate. Their founders aren't going to be there, right? The founder of Symantec is long gone anyways, and they're going to flounder, right? They'll be run by financial teams that know how to twist the dials to make the most profits, but they're not going to innovate and change, you know, change what they do very quickly.
Good observation. Okay, so speaking of observations, now every year you write the security yearbook. Now I've got a physical copy of it, so thank you so much for sending that. It's quite comprehensive, and so I'm definitely going to be sitting down and getting through that. But and we will be linking a link to your yearbook in the show notes. So if you want to look at it, grab a copy of it. We would encourage you to do that. To talk our listeners through like what you cover in your yearbook, because you've been doing this for years, right? Like it's a pretty big book. Like it must take you literally your entire year to write it.
It took me a year to write it. Luckily, you know, I had somewhere to start, right? As I wanted to write a history of our industry. And luckily I've been in it since 1995. So right at the early days of Check Point Software. And I know a lot of the pioneers. So I could reach out to them and get their stories. You know, I record them and transcribe them and edit them. So I provide their personal stories, you know, so founder of Checkpoint, founder of VeriSign, founder of RipTech, one of the first MSSPs, and now CEO of Tenable. And, you know, so at least you get their stories, but my story is the overarching, you know, how did each of these 17 categories come about? What does it mean? Who are the early companies? You know, what happened to them and all that? And I had to write it because, one, you know, I'm fascinated by it. I don't like the fact that we lose that history. Young founders starting up now have no idea what went before. And they should know some of these case studies. And, you know, why did the company that used the same approach you're using, why did they fail? Or how did they succeed? And, you know, tons and tons of information like that, that it's almost like, you know, doing a, you know, a current history book, right? Because most of the people who are involved are still with us. And even, you know, in the last edition, I started keeping track of those pioneers of our industry who have passed away in the previous year, just to honor, you know, their contribution. So, you know, and I found a lot of interest from people just getting into the industry, make it available to students all the time, as well as, you know, the current senior members of the industry. They like it from a nostalgia purpose and also from my perspective. And I clearly say, you know, this is from an industry analyst's lens that I'm looking at it. So take it for what it's worth. But it's the book is also a vehicle for publishing my directory of all the vendors. So every year in the past, we took our spreadsheets and extracted the data and published it. Now we're going to be just pulling it directly from the database. So it'll be up to speed, up to date. It does change dramatically. That's one of the reasons I built the database that we can constantly update. Is by the time I went to press last year, I had to eliminate 200 companies because they had gone out of business. And, you know, I think so far this year, there's something like 145 M&As. So we've got to account for that in the book. And then, of course, funding is just still screaming in security. $16 billion invested in security vendors this year. And yeah,
wow.
That's below last year's record of $24 billion. But it's 60% more than the previous year's record of $10
billion. Wow. That's incredible. I like that you're talking about the history as well, and you said to honor some of these people that have done amazing things in the space, because you are right. I think maybe people forget that some of these larger vendors were founded by someone that started out, whether it's in the garage or whatever it is, and then they've grown to the significant level. And I'm always about the story. I like to understand the journey. So, yeah, I'm definitely keen to get into it and, yeah, share some insights even from my perspective. So in terms of final thoughts or closing comments, Richard, is there anything you'd like to leave our audience with today?
Yeah, you know, think back whenever you hear somebody say the industry is consolidating, keep in mind that it's not, right? So the, you know, there are a few plays where somebody wants to buy particular companies and mash them together that are all in the same space. We're seeing that in the managed security services space. That would be consolidation, but there's thousands of MSSPs. The only consolidation that's occurred over all these years is NortonLifeLock acquiring Avast and a couple of other antivirus vendors. If Symantec had done that 20 years ago, that would have been consolidation. You know, get a, you know, buy Panda, buy Kaspersky, buy On Labs in South Korea. That never happened, ever. Nobody ever did that. But NortonLifeLock, what the remains of Symantec, has acquired Avast. So there's some consolidation in an industry that is already being displaced, right? So antivirus solution is, you know, under a lot of pressure from the EDR, you know, CrowdStrikes and SentinelOnes that have come about with a better product.
Wow. Okay. Well, I think that's definitely been a very insightful, interesting, honest, and real interview. So I've absolutely appreciated your time, Richard. You've given me definitely something to think about for my own journey as well. So I really appreciate you giving up your time, sharing your insight, and coming on the show today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Carissa.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you found today's episode useful and you took away a few key points. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get our latest episodes.
This podcast is brought to you by MERCSEC, the specialists in security, search, and recruitment solutions. Visit MERCSEC.com to connect today.
If you'd like to find out how KBI can help grow your cyber business, then please head over to kbi.digital.
This podcast was brought to you by KBI.media, the voice of cyber.